How the hell can you be gay?
How the hell can you be Polish?
Because my grandparents came from Poland, but even if yours came from San Francisco, that's still no excuse.
Carl, I don't need an excuse to be what I am.
Boy, I don't have enough trouble worrying about some nut beating women up in the laundromats. Now I gotta worry if one of my cops will be directing traffic in a tutu.
Hello, and welcome to Gayest Episode Ever, the podcast where we talk about the LGBT-focused episodes of classic sitcoms, which is to say the very special episodes that also happen to be very queer episodes. I'm Drew Mackey.
That's correct, and I am Glenn Lakin.
You are. And in case that intro did not tip you off, and it might not because some people might not actually remember this show, today we're talking about Gimme a Break.
Which intro are you going to use? Which intro did you use?
Which intro song you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know, because we could use the one from this era, which is all appropriate right for the episode, or the new one, which I think happened the next year.
Yeah. Both are good. One is better. I'm not going to say which one.
Okay, great. Gimme a Break, if you don't know, was a sitcom starring Nell Carter that ran for 6 seasons on NBC, 130 episodes from October 29th, 1981 to May 12th, 1987. Glenn, what was your experience with the show?
Oh my goodness. I watched it a bunch. It was on in syndication while it was still on real time.
Mm-hmm.
And I pretty much watched it most afternoons. I loved the Addie episodes, Addie being Nell's best friend.
Played by Thelma Hopkins, aka Aunt Rachel.
And I don't know. I don't think I ever grasped what the actual concept of the show was. Like, I just thought that Nell was their housekeeper.
It's very hard to figure that out.
Yeah. And yeah, after watching the episode we're going to talk about today, I went and watched the season 3 episode called The Flashback, which sort of clears up what the whole situation is.
When we get to the part where I explain the basic concept of the show, please explain that to me because I would like to know.
But yeah, I was a big fan of the show. I have very vivid memories of particular episodes, like when Katie is in a band and she shows Nell the outfit she's going to wear, and it's like gold chains, and it's like, oh, her nipples would show through that. Like, that was a very early prepubescent sexual thought of mine. And I remember when Jonathan Silverman joined the cast, and I was like, he's cute and funny.
I had no idea that he was on this show until I read the Wikipedia page for it. I don't remember that. I remember that character sort of. I don't remember him at all. Jonathan Silverman, by the way, is the single guy.
He's so much more, Drew. He's also in Girls Just Want to Have Fun.
And Weekend at Bernie's.
Yes.
He's a triple threat.
And also Caddyshack 2.
Oh, I did not know that.
Oh, I'd love to talk about Caddyshack 2 sometime.
That is our bonus Patreon. Every episode is about Caddyshack 2.
And of course, you know, Joey Lawrence has a place in all of our hearts.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize that he showed up actually earlier in the series than I had thought.
I thought he showed up right at the end when it moves to New York randomly. And that is not true.
Nope. Showed up season 3.
Okay, so I remember loving this show, and I remember loving Nell Carter, and I think I was not watching in syndication because I don't remember Chief at all as a character. And by the way, the episode we're talking about is The Chief's Gay Evening, which was the 7th episode of season 2, which aired November 13th, 1982, when I was about 5.5 months old, so I did not see it on first airing. And I'm not sure what to call it. You might just call it Chief's Gay Evening because that's the title is actually matches our like naming style.
Yeah, that's what the episode is about.
But I don't remember the chief. I don't remember the oldest daughter. I kind of remember the younger two daughters because the middle daughter is the one who marries Jonathan Silverman,
correct,
right? And then the youngest daughter is
Samantha.
Samantha gets like she grows up. Like she stops being like a little tomboy, right?
Yes.
Okay. I mostly just remember, I think the last season, which is New York, where there's two Lawrence brothers and Rosie O'Donnell, which is weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not the best season.
No. But it's weird that like most of my memory was based on this. So it was, I actually had to do a lot more research than I thought I would have to figure out who all these people are. In case you don't know, Give Me a Break had Nell Carter playing Nell Harper, who moves in with the
Kaczynski
family.
Thank They're Polish, you. Drew.
That was established in this episode very clearly. Kaczynski could also be Polish, for the record. To fulfill a promise to a friend who was dying of cancer that she would become the family's housekeeper? Is that accurate?
Yes.
Okay, that's a weird...
In the flashback episode, I believe Sharon is the mother's name. Her and Nell are old friends from Chicago. Nell moves to... or is performing a show in the town where Sharon has... or close to where Sharon is living with.
It's like Lawnburg or Green Lawn or something. Yeah. And it's actually unclear where in California it's supposed to be, but it's California.
It's California. And they start hanging out, reminiscing. And Sharon tells Nell, like, oh, why don't you just stay with us until you figure out what your next gig is, while you're getting on your feet. And when Nell gets an offer to perform, I think in Bakersfield or some lame place. Sorry, Bakersfield. I think you were just ranked like worst city in California to live.
Sounds right. Prove me wrong, Bakersfield.
Sharon tells Nell that she is dying and that one of the reasons she had Nell stay with them was to see how Nell would be with her children, which is sort of fucked up. And Sharon is very, Carl is a great father in many ways, but he cannot raise these children. He will just yell at them. That's all he knows.
Accurate.
And in watching this episode, it sort of became clear to me that, like, I don't actually remember any romantic interests for either Nell or Addie. And this relationship with Sharon made me realize that, like, what I kind of clung to with Nell and Addie is, like, it was kind of a lesbian relationship.
Where can I get to that?
Oh, good.
That's interesting. It's interesting that you bring that up for something we'll get to in probably the next like 7 or 8 minutes.
Oh, perfect.
So at no point in the series did they ever play up the idea of a romance between Nell and Carl, correct?
No.
Okay. It's just super weird that...
it was played as a joke in the flashback episode.
What do you mean?
I mean, one of the ways Nell distracts Carl from getting mad at Sharon for something is like talking about how hot he was in his boxer briefs when they first met.
Oh, interesting.
It was just a joke.
Okay. So it's weird that she is the housekeeper and she's referred to as such, at least in like the descriptions I read, because like if the situation you're describing, you'd be like, oh, this is like at least a caretaker or a guardian, or like, I don't like that they call her the housekeeper, even though she is doing housework and apparently she's bad at it, which is the joke in the opening that she like vacuums.
Yeah, she vacuums up the goldfish. As a child, found that hilarious to no end.
Had not thought about that until I watched it. This time I was like, oh, right.
I think about it all the time. But you're right. It's very much I was going to say Modern Family. It's very much like an unconventional family structure. But it is a family and she is playing the mother role and she's sort of the established mother for these children. Mm-hmm. So it's weird. Like you wouldn't call a stepmom a housekeeper.
Right.
And you wouldn't call like a foster mom a housekeeper.
Right. She basically is a stepmom, but they never decide to make them love interests for each other, which is sort of weird in that, I mean, I guess they would make a terrible couple, but.
Oh my God. Yes. And that's part of like the concept of the show is like two people who have different views, who don't like each other, are forced to raise children together.
But that's also kind of the premise of Who's the Boss, which eventually made those two people a couple.
Right. Well, they're both very attractive.
They are. Okay, so Dolph Sweet plays the widower, Chief Carl Kaniski, and then the three daughters are Katie, Julie, and Sam, played by Carrie Michelson, Laurie Hendler, and Laura Jill Miller, who are fairly minor characters in this episode. I was unable to find out if the show was made specifically for Nell Carter or if it was an existing idea that they wrote the character to match her natural personality, but very clearly she is Nell Harper. There's very little, yeah, duh.
Yeah, Nell Harper is a semi-accomplished singer, performer, as is Nell Carter.
So Nell Carter is a fascinating character, and I thought I knew stuff about her, but until I did some research, she is a mess of contradictions. Neatly summed up by a post on the World of Wonder website, blog basically, which describes her as Black, Southern, Jewish, lesbian, right-wing conservative. Carter was a giant talent in a tiny 4'11" if expansive frame.
If expansive is a lovely euphemism.
She's a very curvy lady.
Mm-hmm.
And that is going to be important shortly, but I guess in general, I was surprised at watching this. I was worried that she would be like denuded of any sort of sexiness. And you're right. I don't remember her having a love interest on the show. However, there is a sensuality to her presence and the way she speaks lines. There's like a flirtatiousness to it that you see multiple times in this episode. Maybe it's just when she talks to men who aren't chief, which she gets the opportunity to do here, but she's not asexual.
Yeah. She's not sexless. Right. It's just romance wasn't necessarily ever like a driving through line of the series.
Which is interesting. Again, we'll get to shortly. Over the course of her career, including at the beginning of the show, she battled a cocaine addiction that she credited her very good friend Liza Minnelli with helping her get over. So those people were friends in real life. Imagine what it would be like to be at a party with Nell Carter and Liza Minnelli on cocaine.
I already imagined that in my free time, and I will continue to do so.
She's in Hair. She sings the song White Boys.
White boys are so pretty.
I have seen Hair and did not put it together that the woman who looks kind of like Nell Carter and sings just like Nell Carter is Nell Carter. And she was a Broadway person. She had a lot of success on Broadway and was actually going to play Effie in Dreamgirls. She would have originated the role, but left it to do TV. I honestly can't say what the better decision might have been.
Oh, TV.
I mean, Broadway people who listen to the show are going to be very annoyed that I don't know the name of the woman. Is it Jennifer Holliday? I think it's Jennifer Holliday. I don't know for sure. I don't know Broadway. She was nominated for a Golden Globe and an Emmy for Give Me a Break. And after it ended, eventually joined the cast of Hanging Mr. Cooper, which should be a good thing. But it was the season they kicked off Dawn Lewis and replaced her with like that annoying mom with Raven Simone. It just wasn't good. And Nell Carter played the principal. So she was like an authority figure. No,
there's nothing in between Give Me a Break and Hanging with Mr. Cooper.
She was acting in other stuff. And she, I think, made a few appearances on Brotherly Love because of the connection with the Lawrence brothers. Apparently, she maintained good relationships with all the child actors on the show.
Makes me feel good.
Not all the adult actors.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And she died in 2003 at only 54 years old. And even though it's been a long time since I've seen her, like, on video, and it was like, when I saw her, I realized, oh my gosh, I missed Nell Carter. I didn't really realize that until I saw her again, like, how much I liked her when I was a kid. I also forget that she's dead. And I'm like, oh, that's right. She died. And it makes me sad every time I think about it.
Yeah.
Arguably, she was not straight. She was married to two men. At the time she died, she was in a 15-year relationship with a woman who took custody of her children.
Oh.
And I have no idea if that was happening at all at this point in Nell's life, but that is where her life went. She never officially came out as anything. She probably didn't want to. And her surviving partner is a very private person. I could not even find a picture of her online. Now I have to talk about something that is probably something that we probably shouldn't be able to comment on, but we're going to carefully tread around it. And it was my concern going into this if how much she was a mammy character.
Okay.
So I was listening to, you must remember this, the Hollywood podcast has recently come back and they're doing a season all about Song of the South. And the second episode of the series was about Hattie McDaniel, who was nominated for, won an Oscar for a role in, playing Mammy in Gone with the Wind, and who, after that Oscar win, had trouble finding big roles and ended up playing lesser roles that a lot of people said were Mammies, including in Song of the South, where it's Karina Longworth described it as a thankless role. And if you're wondering like why Hattie McDaniel would have taken this role relatively soon after Gone with the Wind, this is the reason: she had trouble finding other roles. So I was looking around to see what kind of essays had been written about Nell Carter's character on this show. And almost across the board, a lot of people think that she's a mammy character.
Oh, no.
Yeah. The best...
For listeners who aren't aware, because they've never looked this up, Drew and I are both cis white men.
Yes. And do we need to explain what a mammy is?
Yes, probably.
Okay. So a mammy is a character type that shows up in movies, TV, books. And it is a woman who is not given a lot of agency. She's black. She's usually not a slave. It's usually post-Civil War, but she continues to live with white families and work for white families. And she doesn't seem to have a life outside of working for these people. And she doesn't seem to exist for many other reasons other than dutifully working. She likes to work and it's offensive. Hattie McDaniel did play roles that were like kind of subverting that. And in some ways, the mammy character in Gone with the Wind was supposed to subvert that, but it's not something that apparently translated to the final product as well as they would have wanted.
I mean, from that description alone, again, not from a place of actually being able to argue one way or another if the character was offensive, but I do think a large part of the show was Nell's outside life. And although, like, again, like, nothing about her relationships stuck mm-hmm. out to me. Like, I remember vividly her friend circle, mm-hmm. Addie primarily. And I remember the episodes where they explored her past and past friendships and past jobs and even her church life. Mm-hmm. And we'll probably talk about the blackface episode. But Nell was portrayed as not just a member of the community, but an important member of the community. Like, like people who came into the house, Carl's coworkers, almost always mm-hmm. cis white men, paid her respect or treated her with friendship, from what I remember.
In this episode, someone meets her for the first time and assumes that she is Carl's wife, initially. And that's treated as a joke, sort of, but not in that offensive of a way. I'm inclined to agree with you based on my memory of the show. This is the only episode I rewatched, so I couldn't give you details. I thought the best way to handle this would be like, look at what Black writers are saying about the show, and this is how they saw it. They have an insight that we don't. There was a woman named Bibi Moore, who in 1983 wrote an article for the Washington Post where she said, "Give me a break. The primetime sitcom portraying the ups and downs of a gruff police chief, his three giggly teenage daughters, and his comical housekeeper has long been on my list of IQ destroyers. Watch three times and you'll begin all sentences with duh. But after my six-year-old begged and pleaded one night, we wound up in front of the two. Blah, blah, blah. Enter Nell Carter, the black housekeeper, and a whole lot of woman by anyone's standards. Carter placed her considerable girth on the edge of the bed, and predictably, it crashed to the floor. My daughter and the studio audience whipped with laughter. I groaned. My child is slim on historical perspective, but I was born in the golden age of television, and I know a mammy when I see one, and that is what Nell Carter is portraying." There's a few articles that are like this, and some people actually even talk about liking the show, like growing up and then realizing after the fact that she was a mammy character. However, I did love both Nells, Nell Harper and Nell Carter, and I don't quite know what to know to make of the idea that, like, this might have been offensive to people back in the day.
Yeah.
At least
I'm not arguing that it may not have been offensive to viewership then and now. I never thought as that character type applying to main characters, because it seemed to be something that applied to someone who's there only to service the main character. And Nell is the main character.
True.
Now, Nell's there as a mother and quote unquote housekeeper to make the lives of those she's caring for easier.
Mm-hmm.
But I never saw it. Her role as being supportive of the other co-stars, like, the spotlight was always hers.
That's how I feel about it too. I thought of her as a mom who just wasn't a biological mom, but it is an interesting thing. An interesting parallel with Song of the South is that Hattie McDaniel was also a singer and a songwriter and had a creative life that was rich off screen. And a lot of people thought that she was being reduced to that role in movies. And some of the essays I read said the same thing about Nell Carter, were that you wouldn't know that she was such a Broadway talent. She does sing a lot on the show.
Yes,
like,
yes,
a lot. Like,
they come up with many opportunities for her to sing.
She clearly was like, hey, you guys need to keep thinking of reasons why my character has to sing. An episode I watched that I'm going to mention a little bit later, she sings a rendition of Georgia, and it's really good. To Rosie O'Donnell. I don't necessarily feel in this episode, just based on this episode, that she was any sassier or quippier than any of the daughters were. That's just like 80s sitcom dialogue where everyone's being snappy and like doing gentle jabs at each other.
Well, she's gone for the center chunk of this episode.
Mm-hmm.
In past episodes, she is given more like sassy lines, but never, to my memory, the point of sacrificing character for that line.
Mine either. Then there's the blackface episode.
Yes.
Okay, so do you remember why Joey Lawrence wears blackface?
Yes.
Okay.
This is Joey Lawrence's first season. This is his third season.
And he, by the way, he's a foster kid who, like, gets taken in by the Kaczynskis? Kaczynskis? I'm bad with that. Okay.
And so Samantha, the youngest daughter, previous baby of the family, is feeling very threatened by him. And Nell stops her from going to a concert or a date. She stops her from doing something. And to get back at Nell, she convinces Joey, who's going to be performing at Nell's church, that what Nell would find really, like, endearing is if Joey dressed up in blackface and performed in blackface at the church.
So, yeah, the scene I saw is when...
The aftermath.
Don't you dare eat cottage cheese while I'm yelling at you.
What's the matter? Didn't all your church friends love cute little Joey?
This has nothing to do with Joey. This is between you and me.
No, it's not. All you care about is Joey. Joey's report card, Joey's song, Joey's this.
You are being a baby.
I'm not your baby anymore. He is.
Don't you dare start crying on me. I never thought that I would live to see the day when you would use the word nigga.
Nell, that's horrible. I would never say that.
Well, you might as well have. Because that's what you did by putting Joey in blackface. You offended me and a lot of other decent black people.
Again, I didn't remember exactly what the tone of this show was. It could have been like Full House level superficial, and I would actually place it more along like the original One Day at a Time, or verging on All in the Family sometimes, especially in this episode, had some real All in the Family moments.
Or even like Family Ties, where like they had their serious episodes.
They deal with shit. Like, they're not pretending that like bad stuff doesn't exist like Full House does. Like, they actually deal with stuff. I was taken aback by her speech, which I thought was very well delivered. And it was weird hearing a tidy condemnation of blackface that would have aired in like 1984, I think. I don't think I saw that episode back in the day, and I didn't know that happened. And I was impressed that it did that. And I was impressed that they took the opportunity to not only explain why blackface is inappropriate, but to put those words in the mouth of Nell.
Yeah, and because, you know, this is a gay podcast talking about gay things, it also is something that, and obviously homophobia and racism are different, but both forms of bigotry. I thought Nell had an interesting point that it's so easy for our allies to go to that place to when they have a disagreement with us, like when someone's arguing, a straight person's arguing with their gay friend to throw out faggot. And, you know, as much progress as we make in many ways, that like it's still too easy for people who don't know prejudice, because they're not a minority of any kind, to just go at that very easy soft spot.
True. And by the way, if any of this discussion of racial representation in 80 sitcoms is out of line, please tell us. Like, we are two white guys trying our best to understand something. If there's something we missed, we would love to know. Please tell us.
At us. Tweet at us.
Tweet at Glenn, yes. The show changed a lot over the seasons, most importantly with Joey Lawrence being added in season 3 and...
moving to New York in season 6.
And so
Chief dying.
Chief dies in real life, which those poor girls. And then the girls, one by one, are phased out of the show. They all get married off, I think. And then they move to New York, and Thelma Hopkins plays Addie, and Addie goes with her. And Chief's dad also goes with her to New York for reasons I don't think are explained.
Yeah, he sells the house while Nell is in New York sorting out Joey Lawrence's situation with his real father and brother. Grandpa sells the house and then moves to New York.
So yeah, Matthew Lawrence also joins the show playing Joey Lawrence's character's little brother. And then there's Rosetta Lenoir, who played Grandmother Winslow on Family Matters, plays Nell's mother, which is nice because that means Thelma Hopkins and Rosetta Lenoir liked each other enough to work together twice.
Mm-hmm.
Thelma Hopkins is not in this episode, and I'm really sorry, but I have to talk about why I think Thelma Hopkins is cool.
Well, that's fine. She's a recurring character, not main cast until later seasons.
Right, but she's there from the beginning as Nell's good friend. And she's contrasted with Nell. She has a PhD in something. Yeah. What is she?
I forget. But she has a PhD. She's actually, like, reading through her character bio, like, she's a big deal.
So, like, Nell's, like, the artsy one, and she's, like, the one who's, like, an academic.
Yeah.
Thelma Hopkins has had a really cool career. You might have noticed that she was in You're Dead to Me on Netflix earlier this year. She played one of the women in the grieving support group. And, by the way, she looks amazing. Her career on TV goes back to Bosom Buddies, where she's one of the girls. And maybe one day we can find a way to work a Bosom Buddies episode in this. Maybe we can talk about Thelma Hopkins again.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like any episode of Bosom Buddies might touch on something we'd want to talk about.
I haven't seen it in forever since it was in syndication. And again, I thought it was a show for kids because I didn't think it was on at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So why would that be an adult show? She was originally a backup singer. She is one of the singers in the theme to Shaft that says,
"Listen, this cat Shaft is a bad mother. I'm done my Shaft."
She eventually became part of Dawn, as in Tony Orlando and Dawn. And it's confusing because you might think Dawn is just like a person, but she's actually two people. And the other one being Joyce Vincent Wilson. The funny thing about Tony Orlando and Dawn is that their first hit single is called Candida.
Whoa, my Candida. We could make it together.
Which is the name for the yeast that gives you a yeast infection.
Oh.
But in the song, Candida is the name of like a pretty girl. I don't know if they knew that. I mean, that had to mean yeast infection back then, but I guess no one told them. Which in their favor means they probably didn't get a lot of yeast infections. And then
undiagnosed.
they did like Knock Three Times on the Ceiling and Tie a Yellow Ribbon. And I think a lot of people think they might be like Cheese and Camp, but they do a cover. It's a medley of Imagine Me and You and Me and Runaway, like that 50s song. And it is sort of amazing. And I don't remember her ever singing on Family Matters. Did she?
I think she may have. I want to say a Christmas episode.
That might make sense. I remember the episode with Dawn.
I know she sang on Give Me a Break.
I don't remember that.
There is when one of their other friends comes to town or they go to where they're from, the three of them sing in a lovely little number.
I'll have to look it up. I wonder how Nell felt about having another singer on the show.
I don't know. I was worried that you're going to tell me they hate each other. Okay. Oh, dear.
Also, before I abandon this entirely, did you know that she, Thelma Hopkins, is in the first three Transfers movies playing the same role?
First three what?
Transfers? Transfers. You know that like that series, T-R-A-N-C-E-R, where like people
can... Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, she's in those.
Oh.
Isn't that weird? I'd seen those movies and didn't realize that Aunt Rachel was in them, and that seemed important to me. Okay, so in the last season of the show, Rosie O'Donnell joins the cast as like their neighbor in the New York building they live in. Her name is... Maggie or something. Apparently, they really did not get along. This is something I have no evidence of. Like, I haven't had an interview where they said directly that they hated each other, but that is the prevailing sentiment on Data Lounge, which is the worst place to go for celebrity gossip ever because it's a bunch of mean gay people just saying, like, the worst things about celebrities. Rosie O'Donnell has said in interviews that Nell was not nice to her, that Nell would only address her as her character's name, though... Other people said that that's what Nell did to everyone for the benefit of the kids who were on the cast.
So well, also, Nell's character name was her name.
So maybe that's just what she thought. The beef does not seem to be anything to do with both Rosie and Nell being gay, if we're going to call Nell Carter gay, which I guess I am right now. But also, according to some people, she was maybe a little jealous when she thought Thelma Hopkins' character got too many laugh lines. But, I mean, that's a normal sitcom thing. So they didn't hate each other, but that is something I've read. Also, I can't really believe most of what I read on Data Lounge. But also, if most of the information about the beef comes from Rosie O'Donnell, you have to acknowledge that Rosie O'Donnell herself is probably not the easiest person to work with in the world.
What?
I heard that.
Tell that to Dan Aykroyd.
I heard that Donald Trump doesn't even like her. Can you believe
what?
That? Yeah.
No.
There is this episode I watched because I thought it might be another gay episode. And it's interesting. It's about Joey Lawrence has a crush on Rosie O'Donnell's character. And
okay.
Her husband visits and he's hostile towards the husband who's visiting New York because they're from Georgia. I don't really understand what's going on here. The husband wants to take her back to Georgia and she's like, no, I want to stay in New York. And then Rosie's boss comes over to like talk about how he's going through a divorce. And he gets really upset because he thinks that this very good looking dentist boss of his wife is having an affair with her. And tries to take her back to Georgia to prevent her from having an affair with this handsome guy. And then the doctor speaks with Nell off screen. And then Nell delivers the news. We don't have to worry about it. It turns out he's gay. And
laugh line.
No.
Oh.
No, it's not treated as a laugh line. And the way it's introduced, this is like, what, 1987 maybe at the latest? It's treated as like no big deal. No one's surprised that there's a gay person. I mean, it takes place in New York at this point, but it's not a very special episode. The gayness of this person on what is essentially a family show is treated as no big deal. And that is crazy because we don't really see that kind of dynamic on other shows that we would have grown up with.
Right.
It took a while to get there. So
how handsome was he?
Extremely handsome. Like, I'll show you a picture of him. He's
great.
You would look him up on IMDb, and he's still decent looking today. The episode we're talking about, however, which does not have a handsome dentist in it, aired on a Saturday as part of an all-new schedule that included Different Strokes, Silver Spoons, and in the 9:30 time slot, Love, Sydney. We talked about that? I can't remember if we talked about that.
I feel like we maybe did.
Tony Randall and Susie Kurtz, and it was the one that started out as a TV movie about an older gay man living a single life in New York, and they adapted it into a sitcom, and then the network made him go back in the closet, so he just never talked about his sexuality. Yeah, two seasons. Tony Randall also.
So like, we're going to watch it.
We should watch it one day. Most of it's online, and young Susie Kurtz is almost enough to make me interested. And I think it has a good rest of the supporting cast. But
I mean, that lineup before is stellar.
I know. I would have stayed home on a Saturday night. I would stay home on a Saturday night now to watch those four episodes back to back to back, which you could probably do on YouTube if you wanted to.
So if you're hoping for Drew to come to your Saturday night bar thing or birthday party, it's not going to happen.
No, I'm watching old sitcoms on YouTube, and then I'll even splice in old commercials from back in the time so it seems realistic. So I would actually do that. I would do that. That would be fun. I'm not going to do
it. So much fun.
I don't think Gimme a Break ever made it into the top 20 for the season, the entire six seasons it was on TV, which I guess there was a few shows that were like that where they were just never hits, but they were dependable enough that they got five or six seasons.
Small wonder.
Well, no, I think that was always, was that always in syndication?
Yeah, it was always in syndication.
So it wasn't even in, yeah.
I don't think so.
I couldn't find Nielsen ratings for this airing, but I did find an article from the week this aired where there was this very apparently stupid TV writer talking about how NBC shows weren't doing well and they better really try to pull it together if they want to get renewed next season. And the shows they name as being in trouble are Taxi, Silver Spoons, Knight Rider, Cheers, and Family Ties. He's so stupid.
Immediately fired.
Also, heads up, if I sound gross, it's because I'm still fighting off an illness, which is also the reason that this...
Throat haunting.
What's that?
Throat haunting.
I mean, that's a good way to describe it, actually. The ghost occasionally comes out and then flies back in before I can close my mouth again. And that's why this Patreon episode, if you're a Patreon person, you're not getting as early as you normally would. I apologize.
Drew apologizes. I do not. I have done nothing wrong.
I said I apologize. I didn't say you apologize. This episode was directed by Linda Day, a pioneering female director who specialized in sitcoms, mostly soap WKRP in Cincinnati and the pilot to Married with Children, as well as like newer stuff like Sabrina the Teenage Witch and Clueless, the series. The story is by Elliot Stern and Michael Mount. The teleplay is by Chip and Doug Keyes, who are brothers. Chip went on to be the showrunner for Valerie's Family / Hogan's Family.
Ooh.
And then, can you explain to me the difference between story and teleplay?
Yeah. Feature films have that too sometimes. Like, someone comes up with the story or even writes the treatment. It's not necessarily writing the action and dialogue. I actually wonder if this episode started off as a stage play, and maybe that's where those credits come from.
It does have that feeling like a two-act play.
Yeah.
With a break in the middle, like All in the Family. Yeah, I thought that too.
And so it could also just be writers in the writer's room came up with the story, but they didn't actually sit down to write it. It was assigned to someone else. So there's various reasons why story credit and teleplay or screenplay credit would be different.
This episode won an award from GLAAD, which would have been one of the earlier awards GLAAD would have ever given out. But I tried to find information about it online, and it's just not really online. But good job. Give me a break. I mean, we're not giving anything away. I think we were both impressed by how this episode handles the portrayal of gay people.
It might be my favorite episode that we've watched.
It might. There's one whole scene that I'll be tempted to just put in here in its entirety.
But do not.
No. Because we'll get sued. Hey, Glenn, even though we actually haven't got to the actual episode we're talking about yet, you know what I think we're already ready for?
Diet Coke. No. Pumpkin Spice Latte.
I mean, we can get that later. No, commercial. Not for
Diet Pumpkin Coke. Spice Latte.
Or Diet Coke. Please sponsor us, Diet Coke.
They have lots of money. They have lots of money.
Hey, Glenn, remember how I was sick last week and we recorded that episode together, and now it's this week and now you're sick?
Vividly.
What do you think happened there?
Cosmic sabotage.
Okay, enough about you. Let's talk about a love bazaar. Have you ever heard of a dumb supper?
Only every day of my life growing up.
It is actually a very old tradition in which we remember the people who have passed on with a meal in which you cannot talk.
Can I talk now?
No. I'm not sure how a love bazaar is doing their own twist on it, but the thing they're paying homage to is actually really cool. Traditionally, the meal is served backwards, beginning with dessert, which I feel like you would approve of.
Because of my sweet tooth, not the clown from Twisted Metal.
I think it's weird that Twisted Metal came up on this podcast before it came up on my video game podcast. Weird. The Feast of the Beloved Dead event is being held this Thursday, November 7th, from 7:30 to 10 p.m. at the store.
And the following night, a love bazaar is showing off this month's featured artist, Devin Wesley.
That's Friday, November 8th, 7 to 10 p.m. He's a handsome guy who paints people who are beautiful, so you'd be dumb not to go. You want to see some of Devin's work? Check it out at devinwesleyart.com or the Love Bazaar Instagram at a Love Bazaar store.
A Love Bazaar is located at 3042 Glendale Boulevard in Atwater Village, right off Hyperion Bridge. Ask the homeless people where. It's the pink and purple building with flowers on it.
A love bazaar. Find yourself here.
Tomorrow's really special. First, want to learn the secret of being a sex symbol? Watch Bernadette Peters, John Schneider, Linda Evans, and George Burns. How'd he get in there?
Wasn't easy. Had to work nights.
Then Loretta Lynn takes New York by storm with Judd Hirsch, Debbie Allen, Conway Twitty, and the cast of 42nd Street. Two great specials tomorrow. Wednesday, join in the salute to America's veterans of an all-new Real People. Then Blair's new boyfriend creates a special problem on the facts of life. And when an old family friend makes a move on Valerie, it unravels all family ties. Then Quincy faces off with a young coroner who's out to get him.
Just watch us now, Wednesday on NBC.
Hey, Drew, has Patreon made us millionaires yet?
Close. It has made us hundredaires.
But we're on our way to a million, right?
Technically, yeah. And more importantly, we're almost halfway to the $500 mark, which, when we get there, means an entire bonus podcast exclusively for our patrons, the details of which are under wraps. But trust me, it will be both gay and pop culture related in a way all of you should like. Until we get there, we say thank you to our patrons in other ways. And this week, we have three new people who pledge $3 or more a month, meaning they get an on-air thank you and a compliment from the famous Box of Compliments. Glenn, if you're ready.
Uh-huh.
Marcus Gorman.
As empowered as Luann Van Houten after she got the divorce. Oh, that's stylish.
Yeah. She really did get a better set of clothes after that. Good for her.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I know Marcus Gorman. He's a nice person.
He sounds lovely. Mm-hmm.
Jerry Schreffler.
The pride of St. Olaf. Don't know if that's a compliment.
And then finally, Brian Wonders.
I wonder what he wonders. As eloquent as Julius Sugarbaker, but with the down-to-earthness of Mary Jo.
Oh, well, these are nicely themed.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, that works out nice.
They're all sitcom themed. Mm-hmm. It's almost like this is a sitcom podcast.
I wonder who was clever enough to write those compliments. Thank you to all three of you for helping us put this show out.
If you would like to get your own random compliment from the Box of Compliments, trademarked, go to patreon.com/gayestepisodeever or just click the link in show notes.
We have a whole array of patronage levels, and we encourage you to find the gayest episode patron plan that works for you. Glenn, do you think people would be disappointed when they find out the bonus podcast is just us reading ALF / fiction?
Disappointed, but not surprised.
Okay, we're back.
From what?
The dead.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm.
That explains a lot.
Mm-hmm. It explains the smell. Okay, so scene one opens with Katie, who is too stupid to understand juice from concentrate.
Add 3 cans of water. Doesn't even say what size cans.
What about the one in your hand?
Oh, that can. Shouldn't I rinse it out first?
Oh, baby, give me that can.
She is learning to cook to get boys to like her. And in this instance, she is cooking or preparing food for her father to take on a stakeout. I have a reach around for this scene.
Oh, do you?
I do. Katie is struggling at performing a very gendered task. Mm-hmm. That is, women should be good at cooking. And I think this episode, in a lot of ways, is about masculinity and the expectations we put on men.
Okay.
So they are opening with the expectations we put on a woman. Although, in this case, it's played for comedic effect.
It's worth also noting that of the three girls, Katie is the most she's like the cute blonde one and probably the most feminine one.
Yeah.
Middle girl is the smart one. And then youngest one is like the spunky, like baby mm-hmm. sister. By the way, at the time this episode airs, she was dating Andy Gibb from the Bee Gees.
Oh,
good for her. I keep forgetting their names, so I'm just going to refer to them as pretty daughter, smart daughter, tomboy daughter.
That's okay. Yeah. It's Katie, Julie, Samantha. Just say blonde glasses baby.
So then Nell enters and again, says me, my argument in favor of the fact that she's not denuded of her sensuality and sexuality is that she's dressed like she's going out. She's dressed beautifully and she's dressed to accentuate her like curves in the best possible way. She's not dressed like a housekeeper. And I'm wondering like, wait, is she performing later? Like, why is she dressed like that? She's dressed very nicely.
Yeah.
It might just be Nell Carter being like, I want to wear nice clothes all the time.
I think where sometimes this disconnect is happening is that first season did play up the housekeeper aspect more.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was more about her not being good at housekeeping, wearing aprons, cooking, things like that. And I think later seasons, she becomes more comfortable in her role as like head of the family.
I mean, especially after Chief dies.
Yeah.
And then also she gets that, like some of the jokes almost remind me of like the show within the show on BoJack Horseman. Is it called Horsing Around?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. So it kind of reminds me of like, it's that idea of an 80s sitcom. But then Katie talks about how like, oh, a boy's like a girl who knows how to cook.
Now I have to learn to do these things myself. All my friends say the way to get a guy is to really know how to cook.
I know, honey, but they weren't talking about food.
I guess you could say that's sassy, but it's also allowing her, like, it's a little, not sexier, but, like, sex is closer to the surface than it is on a lot of other shows that would have been airing after the show.
Yeah, it's not sexless, it's not neutered.
Right.
But I think that's also one of the things they want to play up, because I think Nell's, as a character, central purpose for being there is that Chief is not able to connect with three daughters in that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's very specifically three daughters and not, like, two boys and a girl. Like, right. The reason that Sharon, Chief's dead wife, pleaded with Nell to stay is because these girls needed maybe not a mother necessarily, but someone with a feminine side who could relate to girls in ways that a very straight-laced police chief could not.
We can call him Archie Bunker-esque.
Yeah.
Which he very much is. So this is actually where he enters in the scene.
So they're trying to capture a man who is robbing and possibly assaulting women as they leave a laundromat.
Mm-hmm.
And so the chief is planning to go to, I guess, a motel room across the street from the laundromat with his two partners or two other officers, one senior, one junior. I mean, one of them is planning to dress up like a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And they also borrow Nell's actual dirty laundry to as a prop.
They might as well get washed while they're doing it. Okay.
I will say they aren't very good at the stakeout.
No. I would say that they seem like they're fairly bad cops. Does this imply that they just don't have any women on the force?
Or, kind of.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. Like, it's 1982. There have to be some maybe this is a small city, but there have to be female law enforcement officers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of my notes was like, what, no women?
Or maybe they just don't trust the women in a position where they might get assaulted, but they're cops, so it shouldn't matter. They should know how to handle the situation. Enter Officer Tom Baxter, who is the one who thinks he's being introduced to the chief's wife. He's the younger one. He's a
kind of handsome.
Yeah.
Like, they play him off as the comedic character. And my initial thought was like, oh, another semi-handsome, funny, gay character for us.
Okay, so I thought he was going to be the gay guy too, because, and maybe this is his clever misdirection on the writer's part, but the joke is he thinks Nell's the chief's wife and they're like, oh, we're not married. And he's like, oh, I got it. Don't worry. Mum's the word. As if he's a guy who's good at keeping secrets. And I'm like, oh, he's the gay guy. That's not where it goes.
Yeah. He absolutely like delivered banter, like one-off gay character on an 80s sitcom would.
So again, points in the favor of the fact that the writers maybe knew what they were doing when they wrote this episode. He's played by Frank Bonner, who played the loudmouth jerk guy on WKRP in Cincinnati.
Oh, yeah.
It's one of the first things he did after it. He also played the parish priest on Just the 10 of Us. And when Facts of Life goes to Paris and Natalie meets that writer who's an alcoholic and hasn't written another book, that's him.
Well-rounded IMDb profile.
Like very firmly ensconced in our childhood memory of TV. So then there's Officer Jerry, who is a double to Chief. Like, they're both paunchy, about the same age. Both kind of look like Carl Malden. Which
imposing,
is
imposing figures if you are a woman or a child.
Imposing potatoes.
Yes.
Is what they are. He's played by Eugene Roach, who played Pinky Peterson on All in the Family, and also had recurring roles on Night Court, Webster, and Soap. For the purposes of this discussion, it is notable that he was one of the main characters on The Corner Bar, which was a show he was on with Ann Mira, who's Jerry Stiller's deceased wife, which was the first American TV show to ever have a recurring gay character, who was played by Vincent Schiavelli. Do you know he's like tall, creepy-looking character actor? The character's name was Peter Panama. And if you saw a picture of Peter Schiavelli, you'd be like, oh, that guy, I've seen him on everything ever. Just interesting-looking character actor. And I looked up, who's he married to? He was married to, do you remember that episode of Cheers with...
Yes.
Coach's daughter?
Yes.
Her.
Oh.
Coach's daughter, who was also on Maniac? Yeah. Alice Beasley. So I think we're at the stakeout now after that, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Jerry and Carl are reminiscing over their 20 years of stakeouts.
And Baxter is very... He didn't look terrible, but he's not used to walking in heels or wearing women's clothes.
Right.
I'm sure, like, any trans person that watches old sitcoms will cringe the moment a man is wearing a dress for comedic value. The joke is not merely that... A man is in a dress. The joke is that, number one, he is clumsy in heels and can't really walk properly. And number two, he has to like adjust his wire and the wire is in his bra. So it puts the chief and Baxter in a position where they're being very intimate with each other. Mm-hmm. That makes them both uncomfortable. I could, there's probably a reason that someone might be offended by like the humor in this, but at the very least they go deeper than a man's wearing a dress. Right. Can you believe it?
Although that is the baseline of the joke.
Here comes Baxter. How's he look from a distance?
Like a woman. A woman who's used to spending a lot of time alone.
So then there's the gay joke.
Oh boy.
You know, it's hard to believe that there are weirdos who actually enjoy dressing up like that.
You mean transvestites?
I don't care where they come from. They're all a bunch of sickos. You know, speaking of sickos, that reminds me of a good joke Smitty told me. It seems this pansy goes into this bar, right? And he's got this big, vicious-looking Doberman Pinscher on a leash. So he perambulates up to the bar, and he says to the bartender, I'll have a Shirley Temple. Well, the bartender takes one look at this Fruit Loop and says, no way, we don't serve your kind. So the puff says, well, you better, because if you don't, I'm going to sick my vicious dog killer on you. So give me my Shirley Temple or else. And the bartender says, I already told you, we don't serve your kind. So the homo whips the choke collar off this humongous Doberman and says, sick him, killer. Doberman goes over the bar, pins the bartender against the mirror and goes, bowsy wowsy. That's Smitty. I don't know where he gets them. Don't you get it? Bowsy wowsy. The guy's dog is a pansy too.
Boy, does Chief like go all out for the performance of this joke. Like, I feel like his portrayal of a gay man walking into a bar mm-hmm. has more range than Chief was ever allowed. Like, I'm talking like lisp, hand gestures.
You don't see men who are this level of sissy in real life very often. And a great many gay men are not that. But it made it hard to understand what a gay person was exactly, because that's the only thing I thought it was.
Yeah, that this gay was effeminate.
Like, over the top, like performatively effeminate.
Yes.
And then also kind of being like confused about stuff and being like, well, I'm not that. So I don't think I'm gay because that's what gay is. And that doesn't make sense for me.
And I was that. So I'm like, oh God, I'm gay.
You went into bars and asked for Shirley Temples in that fashion.
Mm-hmm. And my dog was gay. Spoiler for the punchline of the joke. The dog is gay.
I think we'll have cut it in by this point, but I don't think anyone listening to this podcast would think that, but gay dog owners frequently have heterosexual dogs. My dog likes older female dogs. That's his thing. Not gay. I'm fine with it.
But he's also very into balls.
I wrote that it's like when you hear an Indian accent by someone like Hank Azaria or whoever, and then you put it together with like what actual Indian Americans sound like, you're like, oh, that's actually not what it really sounds like. That's like a weird, like fake idea of what like that thing sounds like that someone made up in their head and just becomes a thing on TV. Fortunately, that is one of the very issues this program is about to address.
Jerry counters this horrible joke with a Polish joke.
That's very funny, Carl. Do you hear the one about the Polak who broke his neck raking leaves? He fell out of a tree. Well, why don't the Polaks have a hockey team? They forgot the formula for ice. You know the Polish word for airplane?
I am 50% Polish, and the butt of most, or the punchline of most Polish jokes are like, oh, you're stupid.
Right.
Like, that's it.
Did I tell you that it turns out I'm Polish too, but it turns out the part of the family we thought was German is actually Polish? Because
that's me too.
Oh.
Yeah, because I used to think I was 25% German, 25% Polish, but it turns out that my grandpa was just like lying.
So did both of our grandparents make that lie in the brief window between the two world wars when it was preferable to be German than Polish?
Yeah, which I absolutely didn't understand that.
Also, my, like, I don't know how far back it is, but my female ancestor who was Polish, her last name is Moraski. I was like, yeah, that doesn't sound German. That sounds Polish. It seemed like she should have changed her name if she didn't want to sound like she was Polish.
Oh, we did change our name.
Oh.
We dropped off the Zinski.
Were you Lake Kaninski?
No, that's my dad's side of the family.
Your Polish ancestors were apparently smarter than mine.
Anyway, Carl, who is Polish, says,
What's the matter, Carl? Don't you think that's funny? Why aren't you laughing?
Well, of course not. I'm Polish.
That's why I don't like gay jokes. Because you're Polish? No, Carl. I'm gay.
Before the commercial, there's the audience reaction, which is like a few seconds long, and you can hear it evolving, where it's like, haha, then, oh, yeah. And then, oh, like a sly, like, oh, I know what's going on. And like, you can literally hear people figuring out the joke as they're reacting to it in real time, which is weird. And it's just not a reaction I think I've ever heard on a sitcom before.
Yeah, it wasn't necessarily the usual, like, I'm gay. Ha, 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 ha.
And it wasn't like horrified gas.
Right.
It was, I don't really know how to.
People were more reacting to the cleverness of his comeback than the revelation that he's gay.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah. Well, it'll be in the clip anyway. If you guys have a interpretation of what you think that audience reaction is,
if you are a canned laughter ologist, please add us.
Or if you were in the studio audience for this, please tell us if people were, how homophobic they were. Okay, so they come back from commercial and Carl's still, no.
Carl tries to change the subject.
I was going to say they come back from commercial and Jerry's still gay, turns out. Yeah, he does. He tries to talk.
But he offers Jerry pickles, which I don't think they play up for a joke.
No, I thought about that too. He does go through like the contents of the picnic basket that Julie? Is that her name?
Katie.
Made for them. And just as he is being surprised that this person that he's worked with for years and he doesn't seem gay is gay, Katie, feminine though she is, has made a terrible lunch with disgusting coffee that tastes like turpentine.
Yeah, this is a meaty scene.
Basically, after the lady, I think you dropped your panties joke.
Let's get a test on Baxter.
Lady, come back. I think you dropped your panties.
Which, again, is like racier than I would have expected for this show. Yeah, how the hell can you be gay?
Yeah.
How the hell can you be Polish?
How the hell can you be gay?
How the hell can you be Polish?
Because my grandparents came from Poland, but even if yours came from San Francisco, that's still no excuse.
Carl, I don't need an excuse to be what I am.
The scene is just full of kind of jokes followed by like actual poignant statements.
Mm-hmm. Again, I couldn't find that any of the people who were responsible for this episode were gay in any way, but it's pretty well written. And they have a jump on, I think, the first episode we did where we talked about a gay character who is comfortable with who they are, who doesn't feel ashamed or embarrassed and has to let the straight people catch up to who they were, is that Golden Girls episode. This preceded that. And
also the All in the Family.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That one came earlier. I forget about that episode. This is not a coming out narrative for him. He's very comfortable with who he is. He's waiting for Chief to catch up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is very important. Again, this is 1982.
Yeah, and this is, as they cover in the scene, like, he had a wife who's now an ex-wife.
But Jerry, you got a kid.
So?
So you must have been with a woman at least once.
Yeah, I was married. I had a kid. The marriage was a big mistake. The kid wasn't.
You know what I bet? You had trouble in bed, if you know what I mean, and you jumped to the wrong conclusions. Jerry, sometimes the romance just goes out of a relationship.
This is a very well-rounded gay character, and it's not necessarily, he doesn't seem like he's in the closet.
No.
Like, people just don't know that part of his life necessarily, but he seems like someone who has an active gay sex life.
Yeah.
He doesn't seem, as you said, troubled by it. This is not something he is struggling with.
I'm gay, Carl. I like being gay. I'm happy being gay. I'm a gay.
That's impossible. Gary, how the hell can I have a gay detective working for me?
I do my job well.
Yeah, Carl tries to run through a list of problems being a gay cop.
Why can't you have a normal man's problems like hernia or flat feet or constipation? Suppose you have to bust some gay guy.
What do you think? Instead of reading him his rights, I'll send him a candygram?
Gary, suppose somebody finds out. Suppose the public found out that the long arm of the law has a limp wrist.
One more crack like that and you'll find out how limp my fist is.
Jerry turns it on him, making Carl paranoid that there are other gay cops in the force. Carl has to go through and sort of question
everybody.
Like, yeah, everybody. Like the masculinity quote unquote, of the people on his force.
And it's wrapped up very neatly with Jerry being like,
well, come on, Jerry, I got a right to know.
You know who it could be?
Who?
An older guy. Keeps to himself. Not very happy. You never see him out with a woman.
Well, who? What's his name?
Kaniski. Carl Kaniski.
You're lucky I don't hit men of the opposite sex.
And he's like, oh, fuck. You may be gay now.
Yeah, and that's where I think this episode goes from being like a good episode to a great episode, because it turns Carl's discomfort with a gay friend and coworker to a crisis of masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of goes in depth into Carl's character in a way that, like, I don't know. Again, I don't remember the show too well, but I don't know that it would have done that in another context or another episode.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good one. Like, he's a good actor.
They're both doing a great job. And I think maybe we get to see some acting from Chief that we might not in other episodes.
Yeah.
But yeah. So he has that line where he says, like,
you know, I may be prejudiced, bigoted, and old fashioned, but
don't stop, you're on a roll.
But you gotta admit that there's something about gay people that's different.
Like what?
From normal people.
Oh, you mean like Adolf Hitler? Charlie Manson, Son of Sam? What the hell have you got against gays? You know what you are? You're a homophobe.
A what?
It means homophobia. An unnatural fear of homosexuals.
Well, there's nothing that seems so unnatural to me about that. What seems unnatural to me is a bunch of grown men holding hands at some Judy Garland film festival.
Forget it. Forget it. You're never going to change. I give up.
Carl goes into a story from his childhood.
During the war, my father was overseas. So my mom and us kids, we moved in with our Uncle Joey. Uncle Joey was a bricklayer. One of those strong, silent, iron-fisted types, you know what I mean?
Yeah, Dukes of Hazzard without the sparkling wit.
Anyway, as a kid, I wasn't the warm, open, loving guy that I am today.
No kidding.
As a matter of fact, I was a little shy. See, I had this stammer, and the other kids used to kid me because of it. Well, there was this one English teacher named Mr. Lamette. He kind of took a shine to me, and afternoons I'd stay after school and he'd work with me, reading out loud. So after a while, the stutter practically disappeared. Anyway, one night, Uncle Joey comes home real late, shouting about how the cops had busted Mr. Lamette in some gay bar.
Goodbye, Mr. Chips.
So next day at school, they said that Mr. Lamette had the flu. Well, all the kids snickered and laughed. Everybody knew you can't keep a secret like that in a small town. I never saw Mr. Lamette after that.
He moved out of town?
No, he crashed his car into a tree. Uncle Joey wouldn't let me go to the funeral. He said that if anybody saw me, the whole town would think that me and Mr. Lamette were boyfriends or something. Anyway, I didn't go. Maybe I was afraid that people would talk too. I don't know.
It really was about, I think, Carl's own insecurities that this man he was close to in his youth that could have been one model for him. He was suddenly told that's not what a man is. Being sensitive, connecting with a child, that is not the model of masculinity you need to live by. The uncle who raised him, you know, beat that into him.
Mm-hmm.
And this is sort of the basis of the series too, that Carl's inability to be sensitive with his daughters is the entire reason why Nell was brought into his life.
Right.
And so this is like his character flaw, like showing emotions is what he can't do because he was trained not to.
Did you think the way he just talked about Uncle Joey being like this paragon of manliness, big, strong guy, stoic, quiet, closed off. Did you think it was going to turn out that Uncle Joey was also gay because I thought for some reason it might go there, but it didn't end up going there. It ends with the teacher who like helped him get over a studying problem died in a car accident, and Uncle Joey doesn't let him go to the funeral. Yeah. And then Uncle Joey, for undisclosed reasons, dies like a man. And
yeah, we didn't hug, we didn't kiss. He just closed his eyes and went.
For some reason in my head, I imagined Uncle Joey was gay, and I don't know why. So that
it's Full House.
Not even their uncle.
It could be like, and that's the thing is like Carl's presented with two models in his life. Uncle Joey, who doesn't show emotions, and this teacher who does and is
punished
for it.
And he clearly patterns himself after. Well, okay. So it's.
But
it's,
yeah, both could be gay. Both Uncle Joey and this other teacher.
He finishes telling the story and Jerry says, "Thank you for telling me that story." And Carl's like, "Why are you thanking me?" And Jerry's reading of the story is that Carl acknowledges that Uncle Joey was wrong. He should have gone to the funeral of the man who helped him, like, be better about himself. Carl does not see it that way. He thinks Uncle Joey was right.
Yeah.
Which is really, again, that's just an interesting little turn where he still doesn't quite get it at this point. It takes a little bit more for him to get it, which happens like in a minute.
Yeah, and that's where I think this episode can apply to sort of the crisis of masculinity that we're all dealing with today. Is it like when men vocalize their weaknesses, they see them as strengths. And it's only from the outside that we're like, oh, that quality you're super proud of is actually really fucked up.
Yeah, okay, I get what you're saying. It's really hard to talk about. Like, acknowledging your weaknesses should be strengths. Thinking your weaknesses are strengths is a weakness, if that makes sense. Like, the closed-off man can't see his weaknesses or weaknesses. The enlightened man will acknowledge that he has these weaknesses and will work to make him better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, Carl literally runs to the bathroom to hide the fact that he is crying and gets locked in the bathroom.
Which is what happens exactly next. Then over, like, the wire's been going the entire time that's been monitoring Agent Baxter.
And again, they're not very good cops in this episode.
The confrontation's already happening with this guy that's been robbing women in laundromats. And Carl can't go, so Jerry grabs his gun and runs in, and the camera just pans to the speaker.
All right, now, take it easy. My money's right there in the purse. Just point that thing somewhere else.
Carl, that psycho's making his move! Jerry?
Look, mister, I gave you the money. That's all there is. Now, take it easy. Don't get crazy with that
guy. All right, freeze. Police officer. All right. Move slowly, buddy. And drop that piece. I'm warning you.
Look out, he's going.
Yeah, they play it like Jerry's dead, and I was going to be very disappointed in this episode.
I thought so, too. Like, just the same thing with the blackface conversation. Like, just not being aware of exactly where the show went, it kind of caught me by surprise.
Yeah. Spoiler alert, Jerry is not dead. He's just in the hospital recovering from being shot.
He explains this to Nell. He comes back to the house. It's like 4 a.m, and she's woken up by him coming back so late. And she asks what happens, and he explains all this.
So, how did your stakeout go?
Well, we got the guy. But Jerry took a bullet.
Is he all right?
Yeah, I think so. He lost a lot of blood, but his condition is stable.
Boy, it sounds like you had a close call tonight.
Me? I was locked in the bathroom.
Say what?
I was locked in the bathroom.
Oh, yeah. Well, I guess that's about the best place to be when bullets start flying, yeah?
Well, that Jerry is one hell of a guy.
It takes one to know one.
I wish you hadn't put it exactly like that.
What?
Which she means the compliment in the context of Jerry being gay is played for a laugh.
But the interesting thing is, beyond that, Nell Carter eventually being in a relationship with a woman is interesting that she is the one who's delivering that line
yeah.
that gives like an extra like bit of smack to it. End of episode.
Yeah.
Two quick acts. It's like basically three scenes and that's it. And I was really, I was really impressed.
Yeah. The scene in the motel room stakeout after the commercial break is just a very good bit of dramatic writing.
I can see why you think that might be like something was adapted from like a play.
Yeah.
That would have been a decent play actually.
Mm-hmm.
I feel weird going back to that essay from the Washington Post I read where the woman writing it thought that this was a stupid show. It's like, I guess compared to like other things, this might have been lighter, but she had no idea how much stupider sitcoms are going to get. Like yeah. if she saw Perfect Strangers, she would have vomited in her own face. Like I feel like I want to stick up for Giving You a Break and be like, actually they did more stuff than you possibly would yeah. have guessed. Yeah.
And again, this is second season. So maybe they're feeling a little bit more comfortable with their modest success or the mm-hmm. fact that they got a second season.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe they're taking more swings, bigger swings. Who knows? It's a good episode.
Mm-hmm.
And the blackface episode, season three.
Do you remember Made for Each Other? It was a TV movie that I think maybe was supposed to be standalone. I don't know. But it starred Nell Carter and Dinah Manoff from Empty Nest.
Oh.
And they have to pretend to be maids because they're on the run from the mob.
The mob shows up in so many plots.
Yeah. I was delighted that Dinah Manoff and Nell Carter were starring in a TV movie together. And like that was appointment viewing for me. And there's also, she sang the same theme song, Made for Each Other. If I can find it, I will cut it in.
Hey, hey, made for each other.
I miss Nell Carter. I don't know if you watched it, but did you see her performance of Never Had a Friend Like Me at mm-hmm. the Oscars? Oh my God, she is so good.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you just think of Nell Carter being like the principal from Hanging with Mr. Cooper, you would not realize that like when it came for whatever year the Oscars had Aladdin nominated for stuff, they had to find a way to make that song get played. And Nell Carter sings the part of the genie and she does such a good job. She's not doing Robin Williams. She's making it her own thing. And she's kind of like a body sexy genie, but it's really fucking good.
But why couldn't Robin Williams just sing it?
Because he's not Nell Carter.
Okay.
And I feel like it's the thing about Nell Carter. It's just that like her being on stage, there's something about her physical presence that is, she's the star. Like yeah.
She has star quality.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sad she died. Glenn, if people want to share their memories of Nell Carter with you, what should they tweet at?
You can find me on Twitter at iWriteWrongs. That is right with a W. And I don't know if Instagram is the best venue for sharing your Nell Carter thoughts and memories, but
it is.
I'm on Instagram at Bros Courts. And Inktober is over, so there'll be slightly less Lego content.
You can find me on Twitter at Drew G. Mackey, M-A-C-K-I-E. Or you can just tweet at this podcast in general, although I'm the one who answers it, so you're basically just tweeting at me. But if you have messages for Glenn, I'll probably send them to him. That is Gayest Episode. Please listen to all our previous episodes at gayesteepisodeever.com. And if you happen to enjoy this podcast on one of the many podcast playing apps that are out there, please give us a rate and review, which are helpful for all the reasons you've heard on every podcast ever. We have a Patreon.
As Yay. You heard
earlier. Yay. And if you want to support this show, please go to patreon.com/gayesteepisodeever. Give us a buck. You'll get all these episodes a week early. Again, except for this week, I apologize for the delay. We're going to have kind of like a mini episode next week, and then I'm going to be off. We're going to be dark for a whole week because I'm going to be out of the country, but then we'll come back and finish out the year with a few more regular episodes, which you will get early, I promise. You.
Me?
You'll get them early.
Oh.
Yeah.
I don't want them early. I don't listen to them.
Listen to them twice.
Nope.
Okay. Our logo was designed by Rob Wilson. Look at his stuff at robwilsonwork.com. And this is a Table Cakes podcast. Table Cakes is a Los Angeles-based podcast network. You can listen to all the Table Cakes shows by going to tablecakes.com. Glenn, before we finish this episode, I need to ask you, which is your favorite Lawrence brother and why?
The middle one.
Because he's the cutest?
Yes.
Yeah. I am going to pick Joey, even though we engaged in a very awkward interview at one point in our lives. But he's very attractive as a guy with a shaved head.
And yes.
I have to give him guts for like his hair being one of the primary attractions he had. He was willing to lose that and keep going. And he looks really good without it. So I say, good for you, Joey. Good for you.
You guys should kiss.
He's very attractive. I think that might have been one of the reasons the interview was so bad, because I was looking right at him and it's kind of hard to reconcile like
how handsome he is.
Yeah. So yeah, Joey Lawrence, hit us up. We'll put you on the show.
Hit Drew up.
Yeah. Podcast over.
Bye forever.
Don't say it, don't say it, don't say it, don't.
To think about
you. Oh, no, no, no. So happy together, yeah, yeah. Don't call me. Oh, don't call. Oh, I imagine it. I imagine it. Oh, I imagine it. Oh, how beautiful it'd be.
Table Cakes production.